Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today once again is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about, yes, you guessed it once again, a lot about ransomware, but we'll also be taking a look at recent law enforcement actions against cyber criminals, the EU's new cybersecurity unit, and how the over 60s lost over $1 billion to fraud in the US.
But first, we published a new blog last week, Dick, about ransomware attackers employing virtual machines in their attacks. And I think this is something you'll probably be best placed to speak about. So I guess if you want to outline what's in the blog, and maybe the first question is this a completely new tactic that we're seeing?
It's not quite completely new. As far as I know, it's been documented once before by Sophos, who noticed that the attackers behind the Ragnar Locker ransomware, a group we call Hornworm, were using the tactic. In that case, ransomware was being run from inside an Oracle VirtualBox Windows XP virtual machine on the host computer and encrypting files from there. So what we've done, and what we've written about in our blog, is found evidence that more attackers have started using this tactic because we found evidence of virtual machines being used in a suspected Conti ransomware investigation.
Right, okay. And I suppose the first question then is, why would attackers use virtual machines like this?
Yeah, in a word, it's more stealthy. Because VirtualBox itself is a legitimate tool, so it's less likely to raise red flags on anyone's network. And the ransomware payload effectively hides within the virtual machine and then goes on and encrypts the files on the host computer. And the attackers do this because they're hoping that the victim's security software won't be actually be able to see inside the virtual machine and detect the malicious activity that's underway.
Okay, right. And how exactly does it work then? Like, how do the attackers install it onto machines?
Yeah, well, we don't have the full end-to-end attack chain. We have a good idea of what's happened. So we don't know how the initial intrusion was performed, but our investigation found that found indications that the installer files were pre-staged during what we call the reconnaissance and lateral movement phase of the attacks. So, for example, in one case, they were placed on a web server so the attackers could easily pull them from there onto other machines on the network. So when these malicious installers were run, they created a file called runner.exe, which is a Golang executable. And the executable kind of depended on multiple other files that it expected to be found in the same directory. And its main purpose essentially was to install the VirtualBox VM in headless mode. Before it did that, it did a couple of things. It checked if it was running on an AD controller based on whether a certain directory was present, and it exited if that check proved true. It also, like a lot of ransomware families we've been seeing recently, checked to see if it was running on a system using the Russian language keyboard layout. And again, it exited if that check proved to be true. And it also enumerated running processes and services and terminated any that were present on blacklists using the taskkill and sc.exe programs. It then decrypted and dropped VirtualBox configuration files and a VM configuration file and installed the virtual machine.
Okay, and so once that's happened, then how does it interact with the files that are present on the host computer?
Yeah, that's obviously how does it go about encrypting them? So what happened during the installation is during the process, essentially part of the process was essentially giving it permission to write access to the host files and directories via a kind of shared folders type setting. Now, we didn't obtain a VM image, but what likely occurred next was that the ransomware payload was located on the VM's disk, and it started up straight away once the operating system was fully booted.
Okay, but if we didn't have a VM image, then how do we know that it was Conti that was behind this?
Well, we don't know for sure, actually. So the reason we thought it was Conti was because a username and password combination that we saw being used in these attacks was previously associated with older known Conti activity dating from earlier on this year in April. However, to complicate things a little bit, on the same computer that we saw the VM being deployed on, we also observed the Mount Locker ransomware being deployed, which raised the question as to whether the payload was actually Mount Locker or not.
Right, okay, but if they dropped another payload on the computer, then what was the point of using the virtual machine?
Yeah, this is a good question. Because the main purpose of running the payload on a VM was to avoid detection, and it didn't make much sense for them to also deploy the payload on the host computer itself. So one possible explanation is the attacker is an affiliate operator with access to both Conti and Mount Locker, and they may have attempted to run a payload, either Conti or Mount Locker, on the virtual machine, and it didn't work for them for some reason or other. And then they reverted to plan B, which was essentially run Mount Locker on the house computer instead.
Okay, so maybe it was a bit of a botched job from the attacker's perspective then, really.
But I wouldn't be too complacent about it. It may not have worked for them then, but I can guarantee that they probably went off and they're going to try and figure out what went wrong and try and do it differently next time, get it right next time.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. And I suppose then, is there anything that organizations can do to stop attackers using this kind of tactic?
There's a fair bit, actually. Aside from using our solutions, which can block the creation of malicious VMs. Tactically, in this case, we'd recommend blocking any use of the VM we mentioned in the blog, because while it is a legit signed Sun Microsystems file, it's actually very old, and it can probably be blocked with little to no negative impact to legitimate business operations. It's very unlikely that anybody would be using it for legit purposes. In addition to that, we'd also recommend blocking any VirtualBox headless process. More broadly, we'd advise using a software inventory and restriction tools that would enable you to control what licensed software may be installed in your network. Organizations who are already using VM software can use the enterprise versions of the software that restrict the creation of new unauthorized VMs. So the long and the short of it is that you probably should be more of the mindset that if the end user shouldn't be doing something, in this case, creating VMs, then they shouldn't have permission to do so.
Yeah, I mean, that's always good advice, really, anyway, just to keep people's permissions to a minimum to prevent them being abused. And that's not the only ransomware-related news you were looking at this week, Dick, either, was it?
No, there was a couple of other bits and pieces in the news that I thought were worth discussing. The first one being that the Revel ransomware group, who are known as Sodina Kibi, and we call the group Leaf Roller, they've introduced a new Linux version of the ransomware.
Oh, right. Okay. That's a bit niche, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a bit niche considering, you know, most organizations, their networks are Windows. And it sounds like that when you look into the details, because once again, it's related to virtual machines. In this case, the victim's virtual machines, in that the encryptor is designed to infect and encrypt VMware ESXi virtual machines. So according to Advanced Intel, who were discussing this new encryptor in the media this week, the malware, it's an ELF64 executable and uses the same configuration options used by the Windows version. So when it's run on a server, the attackers can specify the path to encrypt and enable a silent mode. And when it's run on ESXi servers, it'll run the command line to it and list all running ESXi virtual machines and terminate them. And we think the reason for Revel moving in this direction is that, you know, lots of enterprises are moving to virtual machines, you know, either to kind of maximize the use of the resources or provide easier backups. And of course, you know, the more valuable and the more prominent they are, the more interested the attackers are in encrypting them.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting. We've had virtual machines now in both those stories, albeit mm-hmm. kind of been used in different ways. But
yeah,
it's probably something worth keeping an eye on, I would say. And then what was the other ransomware story that you wanted to discuss?
Yeah, it concerns Babook, which is a threat that has supposedly gone away. So for a while, Babook was one of the more active targeted ransomware groups. But in April this year, it announced that it was retiring, and they have since rebranded themselves as payload.bin. And they claim they're just now operating a leak site for other ransomware operators. They say they're out of the ransomware business themselves. So what's happened this week is that a builder for Babook was leaked online, which could potentially allow anybody else to create their own version of the ransomware. It's unclear why this has happened, whether the builder was sold to somebody else who just decided to publish it and give it away for free, or whether it was stolen by another threat actor who then decided to leak it. And I guess it's probably bad news, because Babook is, it's a reasonably well-constructed targeted ransomware variant. It's capable of encrypting files on Windows computers in addition to ARM-based NAS devices and the aforementioned VMware ESXi servers. It kind of attained a broad range of coverage in an enterprise environment. And the builder also generates a decryption program from the further ransomware. So I guess it probably lowers the barrier of entry to potential ransomware attackers. They can go out and create their own copycat version. And we could probably see more people jumping on the bandwagon as if we didn't have enough of them already.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There's enough ransomware attackers without the barriers to entry being lowered, I think.
I know. And we're probably going to discuss a few more before the podcast ended, because I think, in other ransomware news, there's been a few stories this week which show just how much money is involved in these kinds of operations.
Yeah, so I think there were kind of a few different things happened over the last couple of weeks. We saw some law enforcement activity in Ukraine about a week or two ago, targeting alleged members of the Cloth ransomware gang, which we track as Snakefly. And then following that action, a report came out from cryptocurrency infrastructure provider Binance, which had worked with authorities on that operation and helped them track down some of these people who were apprehended. And Binance said that those who were apprehended were members of a group that they track as Fancy Cat, which they say was running multiple criminal activities and doing things such as distributing cyber attack malware, operating high risk exchangers, as well as laundering money from dark web operations and from high profile cyber attacks and ransomware attacks carried out by the likes of Klopp and also by Petya, who notoriously carried out a ransomware attack a few years ago. And Binance said that in all, it estimated that Fancy Cat was responsible for more than $500 million worth of damages in connection with ransomware and then other types of cybercrime as well. So it sounds like from that those who were arrested in that action were more likely part of a kind of, I suppose, cybercrime group for hire, who seemed to carry out various activities and money laundering for potentially various different cybercrime gangs, rather than being core members of the Cloth or Snakefly group. And I suppose there were indications that this was the case anyway, very quickly after the arrest occurred, because the Cloth gang did continue to post information on its data leak site even after this law enforcement activity had taken place. So it does seem that the core kind of gang may still be intact.
Yeah. And this information from Binance, it really shows the huge amounts of money that are being made by some cybercriminals at the moment, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you think about it, like $500 million is just phenomenal money, really. And I suppose another story in the last week or so as well also shows the massive costs that organizations hit by ransomware can face. We discussed a ransomware attack on Ireland's public health system, the Health Service Executive, or HSE, at length on one of our previous podcast episodes with our colleague Gavin. And the HSE's Director General has revealed in the last week or so that the estimated recovery costs for the Conti ransomware attack that hit the HSE systems is now estimated at being $600 million. So Paul Reid, the HSE's Director General, told the government committee that the immediate cost of the recovery was totaling $120 million, but that further investments in things like replacing and upgrading affected systems and other expenses, such as hiring technical experts to work with them, would likely bring the total cost to an estimated $600 million. And Reid also predicted that it will take months for the HSE to fully recover. But we did also say that so far they had decrypted about 3/4 of the servers affected by the attack. But I mean, it just shows the absolutely mammoth costs involved in these kind of attacks. Like, it's really just mind-boggling.
I know, they're pretty sobering figures by anybody's book. But we'll move away from ransomware for a while at least, because in other news this week, the cost of cybercrime, the FBI said that more than $1 billion was lost by the over 60s through online fraud in 2020 alone.
Yeah, so the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, it's IC3, released its Elder Fraud Report. Now, I'm not calling people over 60 elderly, but that's what the FBI called their report. Mm-hmm. So they released that over the last week or so. And they reported that it has found that 28% of all online fraud losses are sustained by people over the age of 60. And that those losses amounted to almost $1 billion in 2020. And this is up $300 million on the previous year. So quite a big jump as well. And the report also said that the over 60s are the most likely to fall for online scams, and that their losses also tend to be the highest out of all age brackets. The report found that the average loss per victim over 60 was close to $10,000, with almost 2,000 victims losing more than $100,000 to online scammers. And the most common scams targeting the over 60s, you know, they are ones we have heard mentioned many times over the years, such as the classic romance scams and tech support fraud scams and investment scams. And the report also pointed out that the pandemic, you know, there could have been a pandemic effect, I suppose, could have had an impact as more older users were forced online for things like shopping, etc., who perhaps, you know, hadn't really used it, like been online a whole lot before that, so wouldn't have been as familiar with it. With the IC3 also saying that non-delivery of products is also a large source of complaints from this age group, with elderly victims reportedly filing more than 14,000 non-payment or non-delivery complaints, which led to losses of over $40 million last year. And as well as this, the FBI said the data in the report also suggests that hundreds of millions of dollars has been lost by companies through business email compromise attacks that have been unwittingly facilitated by staff over the age of 60. So I guess it's just kind of a sign of people just need to be probably a bit more aware of things, a bit more cautious online. I suppose it's, you know, maybe not surprising that we see this in this age group who obviously lived, you know, probably half their life without ever having to really use the internet a whole lot. And now, particularly after the pandemic, they're probably online a lot, but they may not have the kind of savviness of, you know, people who've been using the internet since they were kids, I guess. But yeah, it's just to be aware. And also aware that, you know, those classic kind of frauds, like romance scams and all that sort of thing, like they're still going and they're still causing huge losses for mm-hmm. people. You know, even after all these years.
I know. The ones that rely on good old-fashioned social engineering, they never seem to grow old.
Nope.
But thankfully, there was some law enforcement activity going on recently as well.
Yeah, so the US Secret Service actually released a most wanted list of 10 fugitives they're seeking in relation to financial cybercrimes specifically. And they're actually offering rewards of up to $1 million for two of the suspects on the list, both of whom were indicted in 2019, and they are wanted for allegedly targeting the US Securities and Exchange Commission's Edgar system server in 2016, which was pretty high profile incident at the time, all right. And other suspects on the list also include individuals who are wanted for things like stealing payment card details, for carrying out phishing campaigns to gain access to digital currency wallets, for carrying out money laundering, as well as for stealing confidential financial information. And I suppose the release of this list is interesting, arriving, I guess, as it does in the wake of, you know, very high profile recent ransomware attacks that we've seen, like that on Colonial Pipeline and JBS Foods. And then also, like, what definitely seems to be an increased focus on cybercrime by US authorities. And I suppose it's another sign that authorities are really, you know, focusing on cybercrime and cybercriminals with a lot of renewed energy at the moment, I would say. And then elsewhere, a man called Andrei Kolpakov, who was a key member of the Fin7 cybercrime group, was sentenced to 84 months in prison last week, as well as being ordered to pay $2.5 million in restitution for his role in breaching multiple businesses in the US. And the Ukrainian national, he pleaded guilty back in November to conspiracy to commit wire fraud and computer hacking. So prosecutors said he had worked as a manager and a recruiter for the Fin7 group that he hired and supervised hackers who went on to steal payment card information from companies primarily in the kind of restaurant, gaming, hospitality industries, with known victims including well-known names like Chipotle, Chili's, Arby's and Red Robin over in the US. And prosecutors said that Fin7 had attacked hundreds of US businesses and stolen tens of millions in payment cards over the years, causing what they said was around $1 billion worth of damages. Now, Kolpakov's lawyer claimed that he didn't know about Fin7's illegal activity and that he joined the group after applying for what he thought was an illegitimate job, which turned out to be a bogus cybersecurity company. And he also reportedly only made $75,000 working for the criminal group. So if that's true, he certainly appears to have paid a very high price for quite small rewards in the end.
Yeah, I mean, considering his fine alone is $2.5 million and he claims to have only earned $75,000. He's really going to hide into nothing there. Now, in further news, further indication that the authorities are increasingly ready to crack down on cyber criminals, the EU, on the other side of the Atlantic, says that it is creating a joint cybersecurity unit.
Yeah, so the EU announced on the 23rd of June that it will be creating a joint cyber unit that will be responsible for coordinating a response to large-scale cyber attacks that hit EU member states. And they said that the new unit will coordinate resources, communications and joint response plans between existing EU bodies and state governments if an incident occurs that impacts more than one state in the Union. And it said it will act as a central coordination point between numerous existing bodies in the EU, including the European Agency for Cybersecurity and the EU CERT, Europol's European Cybercrime Centre, as well as the European Defence Agency and various other organisations as well, obviously depending on the type of attack that occurs. And to launch the new joint cyber unit, the EU said it would also be opening a new office in Brussels to facilitate it, and that they envisage it will come into operation next June. So we'll see what happens there.
Okay. Interesting times ahead in the EU. Okay, that's about all we have time for this week. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, please don't forget to subscribe. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, including that blog we were discussing earlier about ransomware operators using virtual machines, you can check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.